May 3rd was the first of three. Well, actually, there are many more than just three. There are about six different report backs from the Bush Guilty of War of Torture and War Crimes series. This was this event that I'm going to play now is the version that was done at the University of California at Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And we had Daniel Ellsberg, Janice Karpinski, who was the former Brigadier General of Abu Ghraib. Craig Murray was the former UK ambassador, United Kingdom or Great British ambassador to Uzbekistan. And then also Larry Everest, an author of, what was it, Oil and War. And Oil, Power, and Empire is the name of his book. And they essentially were part of a panel that had, for about the last 9 months, been gathering information on war crimes of the Bush administration. And without doubt, those war crimes are now a reality. So this was the one of many report backs. I believe they hit Harvard a couple of weeks ago. They'll be in Stanford on the 4th of May, Sonoma State, and University of Chicago, Northwestern. There are any number of them. I think if you go to worldcantwait.org, you'll be able to find the specifics. But without further ado, we'll go ahead and start playing the report back to the public of Bush war crimes.
The second installment of Sticking the Unspeakable is the Bush administration guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. My name is Tyler. I study astrophysics here at Cal. I work with the Berkeley chapter of World Can't Wait, Drive Out the Bush Regime. Seeking the Unspeakable is a national campus speaking tour inspired by the International Commission of Inquiry on Crimes Against Humanity committed by the Bush administration. This tour paints a clear picture of the full scope and nature of the Bush administration's actions and gives testimony that makes visible the reality that this administration has committed these war crimes and crimes against humanity, acts that by their scope and nature shock the conscience of humankind. This tour began here in Berkeley in March, has visited Harvard, MIT, the University of Hawaii. Tomorrow it'll be at Stanford, followed by Sonoma State, the University of Chicago, UCLA, the University of Washington, and many more places. We in the World Can't Wait think that this tour can play a critical role in forging an urgently needed resistance movement on campuses around the country, involving students, faculty, and the broader community. Here in Berkeley, we've been working with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. We've organized a weekly vigil and teach-in on American torture and the dictatorial president. This has taken place at Bolt Law School, home to Professor John Yoo, one of the primary legal architects of the Bush policy of worldwide torture. I'd like to recognize that one of tonight's panelists, Daniel Ellsberg, was the first person to speak at this teach-in. Tomorrow at 4:30 p.m. will be the final vigil and teach-in of the semester, and they will start up again in the fall on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. outside of Bolt Law School. On October 5th, 2006, the World Can't Wait is calling for a day of mass mobilization to drive out the Bush regime. All day and all night, across the country, we must decidedly break the paralysis that still grips too much of American political life. Taking off of work, take off of school, shut down the campuses, and come together at mass gatherings. We must let the country and the world know that millions of us reject this illegitimate regime that is as criminal as it is dangerous to humanity and the existence of the planet. We refuse to grow accustomed to a political climate that is becoming every day more frightening and reactionary. On October 5th, we will make a breach in the walls being cemented all around us, to say enough, with mass political action that does not compromise with torture and unjust wars, that rejects bowing down to theocrats and the immorality of empire. On October 5th, join us in a day of honest, courageous resistance. And after tonight's event, sign up and work with us throughout the summer to make this day happen. Before moving on, I'd like to welcome up to the stage Jeffrey King and the Constitution Summer Group to make an important announcement.
My name is Jeff King. I'm an O4 alum. I'm going off to law school in the fall. This is Abraham Nisbet, the co-founder, who's graduating with political sciences here. Saba and Bobby and et al. On Monday, we had an event, or we were supposed to have an event, that was fully sanctioned by the university. We had put in all the proper paperwork, and they saw fit to cancel it without warning and without any good reason, and send the police to tell us. We are a group of undergraduate, graduate, and law students all around the country working for impeachment. We're working on four... We're working to present four key arguments. Those are the abrogation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, a felony, the designation of U.S. citizens as enemy combatants, without access to legal counsel, charge, or trial, and an aggressive war, an illegally aggressive war, which was perpetrated based on fraud and the countenance of rendition and torture. We're at Stanford Law School, Yale Law School, Bolt, University of Michigan, Columbia Law School, essentially everywhere, or at least that's the idea. So we have a press release about what happened on Monday. We're going to pass it out. We'd like to thank Wolf Can't Wait for letting us speak. Unless Abraham wants to add something, I'm done.
I'll spend 2 seconds to let you guys know what happened. So we have a student group here on campus called Constitution Summer, performing groups all over the country, working to put impeachment on the ballot to really drive this issue home and to show the importance of this mechanism and the importance to create any mechanism that we can to actually be successful. So we fully created a fully sanctioned student group here on campus. We had all of our requisite signatories, and our faculty advisor was Dr. Charles Henry, one of the most respected professors here on campus. He is the chair of the African American Studies Department on the board of the Michael Jones Civil Liberties Institute, which studies and documents these human rights abuses, as well as an appointee by Bill Clinton to the Humanities Commission. And yet, our event was canceled half an hour beforehand with no notification, and the police were sent to tell us that we didn't have the right to speak. So we then changed our teaching on the Constitution and impeachment to a demonstration in support of our free speech rights. Free speech isn't alive here at Berkeley. I don't know that it's alive anywhere. And that is why we, as a society, as a country, and as a group of activists on this issue, need to come together and find a way to win, because it's just gone way too far for way too long. Woo!
Who's a self-avowed, very conservative Republican. This is a nonpartisan movement.
Before introducing our speakers, I'd like to read a quote from Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights. As Bertrand Russell said then, we say today, we are putting the Bush administration on trial. We investigate in order to expose. We document in order to indict. We arouse consciousness in order to create mass resistance. We want this trial to be a step in the building of mass resistance to war, to torture, to the destruction of our earth and its people. It's a serious moment. Our country and our world are tipping toward permanent war, the end of human rights, and the impoverishment and death of millions. We still have a chance, an opportunity to stop this slide into chaos. But it is up to us. We must not stay with our arms folded. We must be as radical as the reality we are facing. The speakers you will hear tonight are the truth tellers, the witnesses to the carnage this country and this administration has wrought. This truth challenges all of us to act. Our first speaker will be Larry Everest. He is the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. Larry has covered the Middle East and Central Asia for over 20 years for the Revolution newspaper, and his work has appeared regularly in Z Magazine and Pacific News Source. Everest has reported from Iraq, Iran, Iranian and Iraqi Kurdistan, Palestinian West Bank and Gaza, and India. He is currently organizing the Bush Crimes Commission and is a contributor to a new book, Impeach the President, The Case Against Bush and Cheney, forthcoming from Seven Stories Press.
Thank you, Tyler. Thank you, World Can't Wait. We're here tonight because the Bush administration is committing sweeping and unprecedented crimes, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, not in one area or two areas, but across the board. And it's not only committing these acts, it's trying to institutionalize and legitimize its right to continue committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. Let's look briefly at the question of global warming. According to the United Nations, each year, 160,000 people across the world die from the results of global warming, the impact that global warming has on floods, on hurricanes, on water supplies, on drought. This is a greater number than the Iraq War, the World Trade Center, and the Afghan War combined, and it's happening each and every year. What was the Bush administration's response to this global tipping point that could devastate the future of this planet, devastate the ecosystem upon which all life depends? Its response has been to suppress the science that shows that global warming is here and that we're at a global tipping point. Its response has been to gag scientists to prevent them from informing the public of this danger. Its response has been to undermine international and long-standing efforts to try to control global warming. As Ted Glick of the Climate Crisis Coalition put it, destroying the destruction of our natural environment, done willfully and with full knowledge of the consequences, is the greatest crime that could ever be committed. Let's take a look at the question of global health and the Bush administration's response to the global AIDS pandemic. In the midst of this horrific pandemic, which is literally devastating whole countries in Africa, where 10, 15, 20% of the population is HIV positive, the Bush administration is enforcing ideologically driven programs pushed by the Christian right wing that actually worsen the pandemic. It's suppressing science that could help solve this grave, grave crisis. It's enforcing a gag rule that's leading to the closure of needed reproductive health clinics upon which tens of thousands of people depend. If this isn't a crime against humanity, I don't know what is. Then we could talk about the deliberate and conscious neglect of the people of an entire city in this country in the face of a hurricane, Hurricane Katrina. The deliberate and conscious refusal to to come to their aid and to save people and prevent the destruction of that city. We can talk about the war. We can talk about torture, which Janice Karpinski and Craig Murray will be discussing. This is truly an extraordinary and unprecedented situation. And I'm not someone who's fond of the history of this country, believe me, but nonetheless I say this is an unprecedented and extraordinary situation that's demanded an unprecedented and historic, an extraordinary response. And that response, part of that response has been the formation of the International Commission of Inquiry on Crimes Against Humanity committed by the Bush administration. A people's response to hold this regime accountable, to investigate whether its actions in these various fields do in fact constitute crimes against humanity, as broadly conceived and understood in both moral, political, as well as legal terms. In short, actions that devastate, that are systematic, and devastate entire populations, whether in war or not, actions which shock the conscience of humanity. We held two sessions in October of 2005 and in January of 2006. We heard from 44 expert witnesses, whistleblowers, professional experts, former governor officials, government officials, as you will be hearing tonight, who gave testimony in five different areas: wars of aggression, torture and rendition, the destruction of the global environment, attacks on global public health, and the Bush administration's response to Hurricane Katrina. Taken together, a picture emerged of the malevolence and the systematic criminality of this government that is totally unconscionable and unacceptable on the scales of history. Individual testimony, information about any particular area is devastating and powerful. But putting it all together, an even graver and more devastating and more serious picture emerges. And it is this picture which we need to bring to millions of people all across this country and give them the information and the direct knowledge and the facts that they need to understand just how serious this situation is that we face and the rest of the world faces. But simply investigating and truth-telling isn't enough. We also have a responsibility, once we understand the situation, to stop it and to make sure it never happens again. And part of our mission is to challenge people to rise to that responsibility. And we'll be talking more about that throughout the evening. But one critical component, we feel, one part of our mission is changing the terms of debate. Changing the very terms of debate about this administration. Because let's face it, even many people who dislike Bush still do not understand the scale, the scope, the criminality and the danger that this regime represents and the urgency of driving it out. I'm going to give you one example. Bob Herbert, a columnist for the New York Times that I like, he writes a lot of good stuff, but he had a column last week called Stuck with Bush, in which he argued that all we can really do is wait 2.5 years and try to curb the most egregious actions by this government. I'm sorry, we can't afford to wait 2.5 years until he uses his hand. Until he uses nuclear weapons on Iran, assaults even more our rights in this country, and who knows if there even will be a 2008 election. And that isn't as far-fetched as it seems.
Right.
I want to give people a sense. What do I mean, change the terms of debate? I think it makes a profound difference, and I'm going to illustrate this with a question of the war in Iraq. I think it makes a big difference as people see what the Bush administration is doing as constituting crimes against humanity. And again, I use that term not as an epithet against the Bush administration or trying to escalate the rhetoric and bad things we can say about this government, but actually based on facts and evidence and the actual truth of the matter. This is what we want to bring to people. This isn't an exercise in Bush bashing in the rhetorical sense. We need to bring to people the actual facts of what this administration is doing. But it makes a profound difference if people understand what this government is doing as a war crime or a crime against humanity. It compels a much greater responsibility and response, a much greater sense of outrage and resistance than if people understand that this administration is making mistakes or they had bad intelligence, or Bush is an idiot, or all the other sorts of ways that we hear this discussed. So I want to talk about this for a couple of minutes in terms of Iraq. And I want to make three points. And on each of these points, I think if the debate was not what it currently is, but reflective of the truth, we would have an entirely different political situation. And my three points on Iraq are this. Number one, there was no intelligence failure. Number two, there is no good news from Iraq. And number three, there is no war on terror. What do I mean by these things? The notion that there was an intelligence failure and that George Bush thought that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is a lie and a cover-up. The fact of the matter is, as Scott Ritter testified before the International Commission, the world community, all the intelligence services of all the different countries knew full well that Saddam Hussein was largely disarmed by the mid-1990s. They knew this, and there was no evidence whatsoever that had come forward in the intervening years that would contradict that. In fact, the U.S. officials, the CIA and Ritter, debriefed Hussein Kamel, who was Saddam Hussein's son-in-law and in charge of the hiding the weapons of mass destruction. He told them in 1995 that they'd all been destroyed in 1991. So there were no weapons of mass destruction. They saw Iraq as a target of opportunity, not a grave and gathering threat. And just, I have to, as an aside here, I just have to say that in terms of the media's complicity in this, you know, I'm sure most of you know that 13 years of punishing sanctions on Iraq from 1990 to 2003, which killed between 1 and 2 million Iraqis, mainly children, and I saw this when I was in Iraq with my own eyes, those sanctions were maintained in the name of disarming Iraq. They were maintained on the basis of the lie that Iraq had not complied with its UN obligations concerning weapons of mass destruction. And I have to ask you, has anyone in this audience heard someone in the media ask this administration this question? If there were no weapons in Iraq, you found nothing. There was nothing found, zero, nada. If there were no weapons in Iraq, why were those sanctions continued that killed 1 to 2 million children? Why? I mean, that's a very simple, obvious question. Why hasn't it been asked? This is emblematic of the kind of cover-up masquerading as coverage that is too characteristic of everything we read in the mainstream press these days. But back to the main point, there is no intelligence failure. They knew Iraq was disarmed. They deliberately launched a war where there was no threat whatsoever to the United States. They launched it on the basis of lies. This is a war crime. And if people talked about the invasion of Iraq, as Ray McGovern did on the Lehr NewsHour, Ray McGovern is one of our commission participants, if people talked about this war as a war crime and a war of aggression, instead of a mistaken policy based on faulty intelligence, there would be an entirely different political landscape. Point two. There is no good news from Iraq. If you hear Bush and Cheney and Bill O'Reilly and the rest of them say, why isn't the media covering the good news from Iraq? They're not covering the good news. In fact, they're putting too positive a spin on what's going on in Iraq now. This is an occupation designed to turn Iraq into a U.S. neo-colony and a platform for further aggression in the region, a platform for further capitalist globalization in the region, and a platform for having greater control of energy resources across the globe. And this is something Craig Murray is going to talk about in terms of Uzbekistan, the kind of competition for energy resources that is not really discussed in the press. This is what this occupation is about. And our investigation of the commission found that the United States has been committing and continues to commit war crimes and crimes against humanity during this occupation in 15 different areas. And I want to show a short clip of video, and I want to ask people here, have you ever, you know, all this talk about not showing the truth about what's going on in Iraq. Well, I ask you, has anybody seen this on CBS or MSNBC or any of the rest of the news channels?
Which includes the moment at which the Americans carry out their attack. You may find it deeply upsetting.
Tonight, for the first time, you will see something of what happens in the unreported war. For days, American and Iraqi forces have killed scores of civilians in Samarra as they seized the town from the insurgents. For successive nights, they bombed Fallujah in preparation to do the same here. And once they decided to bomb cities, they decided to accept the routine killing of civilians as the price for hitting their target.
It is inevitable that some innocent people are going to get killed, maybe in a higher proportion to the enemy that can kill. And this whole philosophy of using air power to back up ground forces is incredibly risky once it's done within an urban area where not everybody is an enemy.
What follows is a rare glimpse inside America's disastrous attempts to seize Fallujah from the insurgents back in April. At the time, there were reports of hundreds of bodies piling up at the hospital. But until now, we've had little real idea of how American pilots actually go about bombing in built-up areas. Pentagon's confirmed that what you're about to see is cockpit video from a U.S. Air Force F-16 fighter shot in April. The pilot tells ground control, "I've got numerous individuals on the road. Shall I take them out?" He's instantly told, "Take them out."
"I have numerous individuals on the road. Do you want me to take those out?" "Take them out."
The pilot locks the bomb guidance system onto the crowd running along the street.
10 seconds. Impact.
The pilot's reaction, oh dude. Overnight, Channel 4 News received the following email.
From Lieutenant Colonel Frank Smolinski, Chief Air Force Press Desk, Pentagon. This video is indeed gun film footage from a U.S. Air Force F-16 fighter. The mission was not recent. It was in April 2004.
Imagine what other images there are that we have never seen and will never see unless people within the military come forward and release them. And I'm sure most of you are aware that targeting civilians, attacking hospitals, turning cities into free fire zones, and destroying a civilian infrastructure are all war crimes, and illegal, immoral, and unjust. And you're seeing a tiny glimpse of some of the things that have been going on. Finally, I want to conclude with my third point, which there is no war on terror. There is no war on terror. What there is an ongoing, unbounded war for greater imperialist empire, spelled out by the neocons and other people now in the Bush administration over 10 years before September 11th. September 11th was used as an opportunity to seize on whatever their involvement or lack of involvement or whatever the situation was with what happened on September 11th. They seized that opening to implement an agenda they had been planning for over a decade that had absolutely nothing to do with protecting people in this country or with eliminating unjust violence from across the world. Instead, it was an effort that I document in my book to solidify and expand U.S. imperial power across the globe for decades to come. This is why Iraq was the second and primary focus of this war, even though it had nothing whatsoever to do with September 11th, and Bush and the CIA and the rest of them knew this very well. This is also why the United States is now targeting Iran. Again, another country not involved whatsoever in September 11th. And whatever one thinks of the Islamic Republic and whatever the state of its nuclear program, and by all accounts it's 10 years away, at best, if it is even developing nuclear weapons, which we don't know conclusively, any attack on Iran would constitute a war of aggression and a war crime. And I really, how many people here have read the Seymour Hersh article, April 17th? Everybody should go read that article right now. Everyone should read that article right now because he is talking to high-ranking people in the military. They are telling him that the United States is practicing full-scale war against Iran, including with the use of tactical nuclear weapons. That when generals in the Pentagon try to get the nuclear option taken off the table, they are shouted down. Do not underestimate the lengths to which this regime will go, regardless of public opinion. And this is yet another urgent reason why we have to condemn this regime for committing war crimes and crimes against humanity, and we have to drive it out before it strikes again. And I just want to conclude, and I'll be back with some more information about the kinds of efforts that the commission is embarking on. But I just want to conclude with the fact that it isn't, again, simply that the Bush administration has launched an illegal war and an unjust war against Iraq and also has Iran now in the crosshairs. It is doing so on the basis of a doctrine, a theory of preemptive war that is contrary to all the tenets of international law and morality concerning the conduct of warfare. In other words, a country does not have to be a threat for war to be launched. One can attack and destroy opponents, whether they're a threat or not, because someday they could conceivably become a threat. Well, this is just a doctrine for ongoing war crimes and ongoing wars against whoever this administration sees fit. And again, many countries, including this one, have waged unjust and illegal wars. What country in world history has tried to enshrine its right to do so? Thank you.
Yeah. Our next speaker is Craig Murray. He's the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan. He was fired for exposing the U.S. and British government's complicity in torture and illegal detention in the U.S.-backed government in Uzbekistan. He was so beloved by pro-democracy activists that people held signs outside the U.K. embassy in the capital of Tashkent saying, "We love Craig Murray." Tony Blair fired him. His book had been banned by the British government. An embassy report written under his watch documents the torture taking place, including two cases of people being boiled to death. He says, quote, I went to a meeting with colleagues of mine, people I have known for over 20 years, ordinary nice people who were setting down on paper strategies by which what they were doing could be said not to circumvent the UN Convention Against Torture. At the moment, I understood how some civil servant ended up writing out the orders for cattle trucks to go to Auschwitz and felt they were only doing their job. Let's welcome Craig Murray.
Thank you. You are very kind. Please feel free to interrupt this speech with standing ovations at any moment you feel inclined to do so. I don't actually have a speech. I haven't written anything down. I haven't even got a note. It's because I don't know what I'm going to say, and you don't know what I'm going to say. And that makes it kind of itchy. It's good to follow Larry, who I've got to know well since the Bush Commission started its work. When I first met him in New York, someone from our mission to the United Nations came up to me and said, Ambassador, you realize that Larry Evers is a communist, don't you? I said, I don't care if he's a Martian. I said, I'll tell you one thing, he's not a war criminal. Larry Evers never started a war. I don't care what any of you are either. And I hope you'll forgive me some of the more dubious aspects of my past. Larry explained that I'm going to be embarking on a campus tour, and he said we need to radicalize a new generation of students. That need plainly is there. It worries me. There aren't many students here. It worries me. Students have to be on their guard. And their right to protest, as we heard today, of a meeting here, cancelled, and the police sent to deal with students who turned up at a meeting on constitutional law. At Harvard. It's a shame they couldn't teach the police about constitutional law. That would have been a good reaction. At Harvard, I met a 73-year-old man who was protesting at the visit of the administration official with five other pensioners. He stood on Cambridge Common holding a placard in a silent protest, and the police charged them with riots. And that still exists. He has to face the charge. He's facing a jail sentence. You know, if the students don't realize what's happening and get off their asses, they won't have started. Larry said to me, we have to radicalize a new generation of students. I agree entirely. I'm not sure about the methodology. We have to radicalize the students. So let's find an upper-class retired British ambassador and says, I'll do it. I have a difficult task, and it's made slightly harder because I've come to talk to you about things that happen in a country of which few people have heard. You're not alone there. I used to be the British Deputy High Commissioner in Ghana, Accra. While I was there, I received a phone call from London saying, Craig, you've been promoted to ambassador. And I said, great, fantastic. They said, in Uzbekistan. And I said, great. And then I called to my secretary, Christina, go buy an atlas. I discovered I was going to a country immediately north of Afghanistan, a country rich in history, contains the great cities of Samarkand and Bukhara, a country where Alexander the Great reigned for the longest stationary period of rule in his life, where he married Roxanne, a country where Omar Khayyam wrote his Rubaiyat, a country from which Tamerlane ruled.
country which was the center, a country where algebra was invented, but, you know, you're going to say it. The country was the center of a great Islamic civilization, and a country where a wonderful, hospitable and creative people rule under a regime that's among the most despicable on earth. And I have to tell you something of that regime for what I'm going to say to make sense. Uzbekistan is a totalitarian dictatorship of the worst possible kind. There is no freedom whatsoever. There are no opposition political parties allowed. Full stop. There don't need to be elections. The opposition aren't allowed to compete in the elections. There is no freedom of speech. There's absolutely no free media. There's no freedom of assembly. Only state-sanctioned religion is allowed. And there are at least 10,000 prisoners of conscience, people in jail for their political or religious beliefs. And those people are subject to the most terrible Soviet-style gulags. The old Soviet gulags there in the deserts are still in place. Effectively, it's a continued system of Stalinism, without the benefits which, to some extent, the Soviet Union brought to that country, particularly in terms of universal health care, universal education. Those aspects of the system are falling away. The system of totalitarian control remains in place. And all, the president, the ministers, all the senior officials were senior officials in the Soviet Union. President Karimov was president of the Uzbek Soviet Socialist Republic. They've simply changed the communist ideology for nationalist ideology within the totalitarian system. 60% of the people are cotton slaves. Uzbekistan is the world's second largest exporter of cotton. And the people are tied to state farms, kolkhozes. State grows the cotton, the state trades the cotton. If you are born on a cotton farm, you pick the cotton by hand, and you'll never be allowed to leave, because they have a system of internal visas. The people are locked in, and you need an exit visa to leave the country. But not just that, to move from one town to another, you need an internal papuska. You need a visa to move from one town to another. And if you are a worker on a cotton farm, you'll never get it. If you're born on a cotton farm, you're stuck there for life. I was appointed ambassador there in August of 2003. Sorry, in August of 2002. I'd only been there for about 3 weeks when an envelope arrived on my desk containing some photographs. I took the photographs out of the envelope, and I couldn't immediately work out what had happened. It was a body of a man, but from its condition, it was very, very difficult to tell what had happened to this man. So I sent the photographs to the University of Glasgow pathology department. There were a number of detailed photographs, and they had been taken by the gentleman's mother. He had been a prisoner in the Jazlik gulag, to which he'd been sent because he was a very religious Muslim. The mother had received her son's body back in a sealed casket with instructions to bury it the next day and not to open the casket. And the policeman was left in the house. In the middle of the night, the policeman fell asleep, and the old lady, who was 63 years old, an extremely strong-minded old lady, managed to get the casket open and somehow manhandle the corpse onto the kitchen table, where she took these detailed photos of her son. And I received the report a couple of weeks later from Glasgow University Pathology Department, who said that the guy, his fingernails had been pulled. He had been beaten severely around the face, and he had died of immersion in boiling liquid. and it was immersion, not splashing, because there was a clear tide mark around the upper torso and the upper limbs. By that time, people in Uzbekistan had learned that there was a new ambassador in town who took some interest in things, who actually cared about ordinary Uzbek people and what was happening to them. And believe you me, that was extremely unusual in the diplomatic corps. Mostly my fellow ambassadors were at cocktail parties in the golf course and were looking the other way. And the reason they were looking the other way was that President Karimov of Uzbekistan was our ally in the war on terror. This gentleman had been boiled to death in the name of fighting Al-Qaeda. And my predecessor had understood, as my successor understands, that we just didn't talk about these things. But I was so stunned by that, I started to take a close interest. And people started coming to me because they learned I took an interest. I met people who had been tortured. I met the families of people who had been tortured. I saw more photographic evidence. I saw actual scars and disfigurements. I had letters smuggled to me from most of the Uzbek jails. And I realized that torture was being practiced of the most brutal possible kind. I'm not talking about the marginal definitions of torture. I'm talking about smashing of limbs, pulling of fingernails, extraction of teeth. I'm talking about rape, both homosexual and heterosexual rape, rape with objects. And worst of all, I'm talking about rape of people's family members in front of them, and torture of people's family members in front of them, until they sign a confession. And under those circumstances, people will sign anything. People will sign anything at all. And what they were signing, and this was a constant theme from all these stories of torture, what they were signing were confessions that they were members of Al-Qaeda, that they travelled to Afghanistan and seen Osama bin Laden, and that other named people were members of Al-Qaeda or of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan linked to Al-Qaeda. I met an older man whose children had been tortured in front of him until he testified that two of his nephews had travelled to Afghanistan and met Osama bin Laden. That man actually didn't know who Osama bin Laden was. Now then, at the same time as British ambassador, I was receiving the CIA intelligence material from Uzbekistan. Now, it's important that all of what I'm coming on to explain to you, that you understand the United States, United Kingdom intelligence sharing agreement. Under this agreement, the United Kingdom and the United States share all their intelligence. This has been in place since Roosevelt and Churchill. MI6 and the CIA share all theirs, and NSA and GCHQ share all theirs. Now, we didn't actually have an MI6 station in Tashkent because it was too dangerous. Forget James Bond films, okay? That's a myth. MI6 was too dangerous. In reality, these guys don't serve anywhere you can't buy a cappuccino. But to be fair to the CIA, they were there. And they were cooperating very closely with the Uzbek regime and the Uzbek security services. Let me give you an idea how closely. In 2002, according to an American embassy press release of December 2002, you, the American taxpayers, you gave $500 million in aid to the Uzbek regime, of which $120 million went to the Uzbek military, and $82 million went to the Uzbek security services. Let me put it this way. This sounds gross, but it brings it home. When they boiled that guy to death, you paid to heat the water. the CIA were there in force, and I was seeing the CIA intelligence material. Now, the CIA intelligence material said exactly the same things that the people were being made to sign up to under torture. It said, this opposition member is a member of Al-Qaeda. That dissident has travelled to Afghanistan and met Osama bin Laden. And exactly like the confessions extracted under torture, it was untrue. A lot of this material was demonstrably false. When I'm asked how I know that, I'd like to give a couple of examples. One of the CIA intelligence reports said that a well-known dissident was a member of Al-Qaeda. I knew this gentleman and happened to know he was a Jehovah's Witness. Now, but Al-Qaeda's not big on Jehovah's Witnesses. But the portion of Al-Qaeda members who are Jehovah's Witnesses is extremely small. There was another intelligence report which spoke of an Islamic movement of Uzbekistan training camp as a named location in the hills above Samarkand. We looked and there was nothing there. There was physically nothing at that location. It was just untrue. And if I could look, the CIA could. They got bigger and more stuff than I did. And I was getting seriously concerned. Here we had this large pattern of false intelligence, the whole aim of which was to exaggerate the Islamic threat, the threat of Islamic terrorism. We have people being tortured to the same end. And the intelligence material was saying it came from detainee debriefing. Detainee debriefing. By a friendly security service. And this is something I should explain to you. The material is sanitized. The CIA, I have it happen to see, Uzbek Security Service, torture this guy, get into silent confession. They go, and we just have to go far, because the CIA were there in the ministry. They go, they pass it to the CIA guy. The CIA guys aren't there when the torture's done. They're, you know, a few officers away. The Uzbeks come, they pass it over. The CIA take the material, they put it in a report that they issue and deliver to their customers. I was one of their customers, as Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice and others were customers. And that material says, from detainee debriefing, by then the intelligence service, the detainee said that X, Y, and Z are all members of Al-Qaeda. And it doesn't tell you on the report who the detainee is. And this is to give so-called plausible deniability. This is why Condoleezza Rice can say, as she has said, I have never knowingly read a piece of intelligence that was obtained under torture, because it's a bloody fraud. The material was deliberately delivered in such a way that makes them say, you cannot prove that was the guy who was interrogated. You cannot link it to a specific person who was tortured. And that's one of the means of circumlocution they use to cover up what's happening. And the idea is that no one on the inside will blow the story of how it happens. Well, that didn't work, did it? Very concerned. And I asked my deputies to go over to the American embassy and say to them, my ambassador thinks this material is coming from torture. Do you have anything in place to make sure it doesn't? Because I didn't want to go back to London and complain and find I was undermined by something, some other subterfuge, if you like. But she came back and she reported to me, she said, now, Ambassador, the American Embassy, they said, yes, it probably does come from torture, But no, we don't see that as a problem in the context of the war on terror. I complained to my my Secretary of State, Jack Straw. I sent back telegram saying this was illegal and immoral and impractical because the material the intelligence contained just wasn't true. I received no reply to that. That was in November of 2002. So in late January or early February of 2003, I sent back a second telegram saying the same stuff. And in early March 2003, I was summoned back to London. And we held a meeting, which was on either the 7th or the 8th of March 2003, whichever of those dates is decided. And at that meeting, I was informed by Sir Michael Wood, the Foreign Office's chief legal advisor, that the legal position was that it was not illegal for the government of the United Kingdom to obtain intelligence under torture, provided we neither did the torturing ourselves nor specifically requested that a named individual be tortured. Now then, what kind of civilization are we becoming when we set our government lawyers to setting out legal justifications for torture? I'm actually in a country which leads the world on government lawyers setting out legal justifications for torture at the moment, and it's a bloody disgrace. We should not be putting that. Down to two more standing ovations. I was also told at that same meeting that my telegrams had caused concern in Whitehall. possibly an understatement. That Jack Straw had held a meeting with the head of MI6, who in the James Bond films is known as M, but in real life is known as C. I just wanted to... It's like, give me that scientific information. Jack Straw had held a meeting with C, Secretary of DLR. Oh, that was a secret, sorry. and they had decided, as a matter of policy, that in the war on terror, we would use intelligence obtained by torture from foreign security services. That was the policy decided by our Secretary of State. I was also told that because of the UK-US intelligence sharing agreement, it was not open to us to have a different policy on this issue than the United States. So, that's the truth of it. As Larry said, you know, this is where we have the evidence. And you know, there are people whose children are being tortured in front of their eyes so the CIA can get the intelligence. And the intelligence is bad intelligence. But I say this, even if it was good intelligence, I would rather die than have that happen to protect me, and I hope that's true of all of you too. To the question of why. Why are they doing this? Why do they want to get false intelligence? Why did they want to pay this dictator $500 million? Well, the answer lies in a letter written in June of 1997 to Governor George Bush, Governor of Texas. And you can find this letter on my website, which is craigmurray.co.uk. As you can find many of the documents that support the story I'm telling. In 1997, George Bush received a letter from a gentleman called Mr. Kenneth Lay, of Enron. And in that letter, Ken Lay, it was an interesting letter, it started, "Dear Governor Bush," and Ken Lay had crossed out Governor Bush in his own hand and written George, which was interesting because the two hardly knew each other, as we now know. And for the benefit of lawyers present, let me just say, Ken Lay is a man who has not been convicted of anything yet. He says, "Dear George, you will be meeting the ambassador of Uzbekistan." And if I didn't know where Uzbekistan is, that must have come as a hell of a surprise to George. "To discuss a contract which Enron has signed with the government of Uzbekistan for a $2 billion contract to discuss Enron's oil and gas resources." And that's what it was about. It's nothing to do with Osama bin Laden. It's nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. Before 2000, not before 2001, before 2000, America had a totally different policy towards Uzbekistan. Madeleine Albright made an extremely strong speech condemning the Uzbek regime. The change in American policy towards Uzbekistan, to treat it as an ally rather than an enemy, came with the election of George Bush and his commitment to promoting Enron's oil and gas interests. And all this stuff on the war on terror, all this CIA intelligence about links to IMU and Al-Qaeda, was simply an elaborate blind to disguise the hard-headed pursuit of corrupt business interests. That's what this is all about, just as that's exactly what the war in Iraq is about, and that just as exactly that's what any war on Iran would be about. These people are not stupid, these people are greedy and dangerous, and that's the lesson to draw from my experiences in Uzbekistan. In the same year that $500 million was given to support a dictator in Uzbekistan, apparently we were going to war to topple a dictator in Baghdad because we're against dictators. Well, the answer is that Bush is for dictators if they let him get the oil and gas, and against them if they don't. And the policy has nothing to do with democracy, nothing to do with human rights. It's about commercial exploitation, pure and simple. American foreign policy makes no sense if you analyze it in a matrix of democracy and freedom. It makes every sense if you analyze it as a simple, old-fashioned grab for resources. And that's what we're faced with. We're faced with that dressed up with a cloak of religious enthusiasm that leads to the demonization and persecution of Muslims. And what worries me was this definite subtext that it didn't matter what happened to those people in Uzbekistan, like it didn't matter what happened to people at Abu Ghraib, like it doesn't matter what happened to people in Guantanamo, because they're not us, they're only Muslims. And that is the road down which Adolf Hitler successfully led people, and we are not going to go there. Religious fundamentalism is a dangerous thing. This world does suffer a threat of religious fundamentalism. But it doesn't only suffer it from Osama bin Laden, it also suffers it from George Bush and his followers on the extreme religious right. George Bush talks to God. Even more worryingly, God talks to George Bush. You know, I always find that difficult to believe. Let me put it this way. Now, I'm God,
Okay. I can talk to anyone I like. I'm going to choose George Bush? No way. I'm going for Angelina Jolie myself. I warn you, I haven't got speech. You know, I really do worry enormously. I worried so much when I saw people in the British administration going along with justifications for torture, and people who I knew agreed with me afraid to speak out. When I did speak out, I lost my job. That's the debt they hold over people. But what we need is people to say there are things more important than your job. We need to fight for freedom, because we are at the start of a road that leads somewhere very, very nasty indeed. And you don't have to go very far down that road before there is no turning back. So now is the time to fight. We must support the Bush Commission, and I urge you all, please get out there, get active in your communities, and let's get a real movement going to fight this evil. Thank you very much, Peter.
Our next speaker is Janice Karpinski. U.S. Army Reserve Brigadier General Janice Karpinski had been in command of Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison for only 4 months in 2003 when photographs surfaced in the media, sparking an international outcry. In the wake of the scandal, the military launched a formal investigation of Karpinski, and 16 fellow reservists were suspended from duty. A career military officer and the first woman to serve as a commanding general in combat, Karpinski was demoted to colonel in May of 2005 on a technicality. In October 2005, she published an account of her experiences, One Woman's Army, the commanding general of Abu Ghraib tells her story, in which she claims that the abuses were perpetrated by contracted employees trained in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, and sent under orders from Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and her demotion was political retribution. But welcome, Janice Karpinski.
Let's get on to the real controversy, huh? Thank you all for coming. Thank you for your interest, and appreciate your support and your willingness to listen to the truth. I think it's important, I don't want to say to cut to the chase, but it is important to cut to the chase. In April of 2004, when the world saw the pictures from Abu Ghraib for the first time, I was shocked once again in seeing them, and I was further shocked because the only name that they were linking to those pictures was mine. And being that just 72 hours before those pictures were released, when I was given permission finally to leave Iraq and come home, or back to the States on redeployment, I was told before I left by a three-star general who was in charge of the Army component at the time, Lieutenant General McKiernan. He said to me, look, I saw the investigation, meaning the Taguba investigation, and I saw the results and his conclusions, and I also saw his recommendations. And he said, and I don't have to agree with any of them. And I don't. There were mistakes that were made, but they weren't necessarily yours. He said, I am not a fan of General Sanchez, and I think that there's more to be done. He said to me, there's a great future for Janice Karpinski in the Army Reserve. He told me two things. My recommendations, you don't have to take them. He said, don't make this an issue between the male and female components. Of course, it is largely a motivation. and don't make this an issue between the reserve components and the regular army, which is another component of the problem. But he didn't discuss the photographs or the activities or the history that was of torture and abuse in other locations, Afghanistan or Guantanamo Bay. I came back to the United States, and as I said, less than 48 hours later, the pictures were released to the major media outlets, and the only name that they were using was mine. And it was a awful realization at that point that the system that I had supported through the military for more than 25 years was abandoning me, and they were using me and the seven soldiers as the scapegoats. Convenient, ready, tie it up in a neat little package. Several days later, the President of the United States, who's apologizing to the world, says, this was just simply seven so-called bad apples out of control on the night shift. And he stopped short of saying, and their commander was a female. But it was implied. And he hoped to tie it up in a neat little package and dismiss it, and let's move on to the next issue. And perhaps he could have, except for the photos. And once people saw those photos, people like Ambassador Murray started to speak out. And you see a pattern emerge, a pattern of destructive behavior. So I have to go back in time a little bit for you now. In July of 2003, when I arrived in Iraq to take command of the 800th Military Police Brigade, I was told before I left the United States to go to Iraq that I would probably only see the soldiers, as many of them were getting on an airplane to come back to the United States, because their mission of prisoner of war operations and internment resettlement was largely over. That was the regular mission of the units that I would command, prisoner of war operations. And with the declaration of victory on the 1st of May and the end of major combat operations, prisoner of war release operations kick in immediately. But when I arrived, I was told, the units aren't going home because we're assigning you this new mission. We want you to go up to Iraq, up to Baghdad, and assist the prisons experts at Ambassador Bremer's headquarters with reconstruction and reopening of the prisons throughout Iraq. This was for the Iraqi criminal element. There was no discussion, no plan, like usual. There was no concerns, do you have the right equipment, do you have the right number of people, are they appropriately trained, is this the right unit to go? They just simply dropped this mission on us and sent us up into Baghdad and other cities in and around Iraq to do this new mission. Well, we got to Baghdad and sat down with the prisons experts in Ambassador Bremer's headquarters. Their own estimation was that they needed 83 civilians to run and rebuild the prison system for all of Iraq. And they had three. And then one managed to get fired. So they were going to rely almost exclusively on the military personnel to do this operation, despite the fact that they were funded and for 83 people, but most of that money somehow disappeared. But that's another story. So one of the facilities that we were told to take a look at and use was Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib was well known not only in Iraq but throughout the Middle East as one of the most notorious locations, prison locations, under the Saddam regime. There were hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who were tortured there, held there, mostly political prisoners, and ultimately gave their lives there, following torture for some reports days at a time. So we had great concerns about using Abu Ghraib for anything. The first concern was that it was located in the middle of the Sunni Triangle. It was then, and it is even worse today, one of the most dangerous locations in all of Iraq. It is no place to run any kind of detention operations. Abu Ghraib itself was 60 acres, heavily looted, like all of the prisons throughout Iraq. But the feature of Abu Ghraib that gave us some reason to use it or consider to use it was this 20-foot-high wall that surrounded these 60 acres. So we had some security from a ground attack to hold the Iraqi criminal population until we could get other prison facilities ready to transfer them. So we had a plan, and our plan was to use it for only as long as necessary until we had the other facilities ready to transfer prisoners. We were ahead of schedule, in fact, by the end of July, because we had a smaller prisoner population, and we had facilities becoming available. And then, towards the end of August, after the operation up near Mosul with the 101st Air Assault Division, when they killed Uday and Qusay, Saddam's sons, they exploited the information at that location, and as a result, they were able to develop target lists of specific individuals that they thought had a direct connection and would perhaps lead them to Saddam or Osama bin Laden himself. At the end of August, the divisions were now turning in a new category of prisoner, security detainees. And they didn't make a distinction between security detainees for us, but they were telling the military intelligence personnel that this was a new category of detainee, and they were supposed to modify their questions to ask them specifically about their connection to terrorism. And then Major General Miller arrived in Iraq. He was sent to Iraq by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and specifically his Undersecretary for Military Intelligence, Stephen Cambone. General Miller was the commander of Guantanamo Bay. He was commander of the interrogation operations, a combination of military police and military intelligence functions. It was the first time that the two functions were combined together in any location. General Miller put the plan together, and he said he needed to use the military police personnel to set effective conditions for interrogation, and then the military intelligence personnel would actually do the interrogation. There was a critical shortage of military intelligence interrogators, so they hired contract interrogators, outsourcing interrogation operations. And some of those contractors were subsequently selected, handpicked by name, after they received their experience in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay and perhaps in some of the secret facilities around the world. They were handpicked and sent to Iraq, specifically to Abu Ghraib, to help the interrogators with their new techniques to get more actionable intelligence. When General Miller came to Iraq, he had a briefing with the military intelligence personnel, because military intelligence operations are separate and apart from military police operations. And I was in charge of 17 prison facilities, military police personnel doing detention operations. The military intelligence commander, Colonel Pappas, did not work for me. He did not report to me. Interrogations were a separate chain of command. When General Miller came to visit, he was clearly directed to work with the military intelligence personnel. I was invited at the ninth hour to come in and sit on his introductory briefing, and it was the only time that I heard General Miller in responding to a military intelligence soldier's question about what they could do immediately to get better information, because they thought that they were in compliance with what they'd been trained to do. And he said, look, you have to treat the prisoners like dogs. Pretty shocking when several months later we saw that photograph, but he said, if the prisoner believes that you have lost control, that they have any say, you have effectively lost control of your interrogation. And he said, he is the example. When prisoners arrived at Guantanamo Bay, they were immediately placed in hand irons and leg irons and belly chains. They were escorted everywhere by two military police personnel, and they earned every single thing they had, to include, and the example he used was a change in color and jumpsuit. I was just an invited guest to his briefing, but I couldn't help it. I just raised my hand and I said, sir, we don't have enough funding here to buy one jumpsuit for each prisoner, let alone a change of colors. And he said, that's not an issue. My budget is $125 million a year for interrogation operations, and I'm going to give the military intelligence commander all the money he needs to make this work. Well, in the course of that visit, General Miller went out to see Abu Ghraib several times, decided that he wanted Abu Ghraib. In fact, the day before he left Iraq, he had a meeting, he called me in, and he told me he wanted me to give him Abu Ghraib, that was the location that he had selected. He was going to gizmoize the operation. And he did. I told him, in responding to that statement, Abu Ghraib is not mine to give you, sir. And he cleared the room. He said he wanted to speak to me alone. And he said to me, look, we can do this my way, or we can do this the hard way. I mean, we're on the same team, aren't we? Apparently not, for many reasons. But he, in fact, did what he said he was going to do that day, mid-September in 2003. It took him less than 2 months to effectively get everything he said he wanted. He got Abu Ghraib. He got it. The focus was interrogation operations. And he sent the people to do his work. He handpicked some military personnel, but mostly contract interrogators who had experience at Guantanamo Bay and in Afghanistan, and he sent them to Abu Ghraib specifically to deal with interrogation operations with this massive population of security detainees. The reason that new category of prisoners is important is because it makes the connection between what is now called the torture memo. The memo signed by Alberto Gonzalez and has been rescinded now, but at that time it was in effect. I never saw that memo. It was never provided to anybody in 800th Military Police Brigade because we were not responsible for interrogation operations. But the tenets of that memo is what was giving General Miller his authority. And he transferred his authority and his knowledge during that visit and told the interrogators that they had the authority to do these things. And then he sent contract interrogators who had been using those techniques and are apparently above and beyond the law. The Uniform Code of Military Justice does not apply to contract interrogators, and apparently regular law doesn't apply to them. So they were able to do whatever they needed to do to get more actionable intelligence from their interrogation procedures. It's also very important to understand that what you saw in those photographs, despite the fact that they were promoted immediately as interrogation, photographs taken during interrogations, there was no interrogation taking place in any of those photographs. Those photographs were set up and staged, and the purpose of those photographs were to be used in interrogations because they had thousands of these security detainees. They didn't have, the interrogation teams did not have the time necessary to go back and talk to them again. So the plan was that they would bring a new security detainee into the interrogation booth. If they didn't start to show cooperation right from the start, they'd open a laptop computer, show them the picture, and say, start talking, or tomorrow you're on the bottom of the pile. That was the purpose of the intended purpose of the photographs. When General Miller came to Abu Ghraib, we, over the course of July and August, because of the notoriety of Abu Ghraib, we specifically changed the name of Abu Ghraib. We started to refer to it as Baghdad Central Correctional Facility. And soldiers changed it, the name, to BCCF, of course, like they always will do. Because we were concerned that no matter what was going on at Abu Ghraib, no matter how well the prisoners were being treated, no matter how austere the conditions were, if family members heard that their loved ones had been transported to Abu Ghraib, they would be sure that the same conditions that applied under Saddam were being applied to them then. We wanted them to know that this was a different way of running prison operations. And that worked for about 6 weeks. But when General Miller came to Iraq and he heard this reference to BCCF, he ordered the military intelligence commander to make sure that they did not refer to it as BCCF, he ordered him to start referring to it as Abu Ghraib and to tell all of the interrogators to start referring to it as Abu Ghraib and to tell all of the division interrogators, the divisions were out in all of the areas around Iraq, tell them to start referring to it as Abu Ghraib. Why? Because they were exploiting the notoriety and the brutality of the name. So when you are talking about setting effective conditions for interrogations, as soon as you apprehend somebody, innocent or not, on the outside, and you're holding that individual, all you have to do is say, okay, don't cooperate. Tomorrow you're going to Abu Ghraib. And so you are already effectively terrorizing them before you have done anything. And that was intentional, that was by design, and it was ordered by General Miller, certainly with the knowledge and the permission of the Secretary of Defense and the Undersecretary, Stephen Cambone. When I first heard about the investigation, and excuse me, I have to back up again, November of 2003, by official order signed by Sanchez, the prison was transferred from control of the military police brigade, me, to the commander of the military intelligence brigade, Colonel Pappas. So now you have a detention operation in the course of 2 months under General Miller's direction that has now morphed into an interrogation center for all of Iraq. And it's called Abu Ghraib. I had 16 other prison facilities to run. When I heard about this ongoing investigation, January of 2004, I was not even in Baghdad. I opened up classified message traffic. I came back from a very late meeting with some leaders from another organization. And I said, what's this all about? And I saw an email there from the commander of the Criminal Investigation Division. I opened it up, and three sentences. Ma'am, just wanted you to know I'm going in to brief the CG, meaning the Commanding General, General Sanchez, on the progress of the investigation at Abu Ghraib. Progress means ongoing. Already underway. This is about the allegations of prisoner abuse and the photographs. Well, I was alarmed. First I heard of it, and I'm not hearing about it from General Sanchez. I'm not hearing about it from anybody in my chain of command. I'm hearing about it from actually a colleague, the commander of the Criminal Investigation Division. Daybreak the next morning, when you're allowed to travel on the roads with some safety, some degree of safety, we do. We go down to Abu Ghraib, and I want to talk to somebody. I want to talk to the soldiers, ask them what the heck is going on, what do they know, what is this ongoing investigation, only to discover the people that would normally be working in the cell block have all been removed. And they're not even at Abu Ghraib any longer. They've been taken to some other location. So I talked to the MP who's there. I asked him to see the files, the records, the log, any information. He said they did question a lot of the MPs, but if you didn't work the cell block, they didn't have much to say. And I said, where are your files? He said, they confiscated everything, ma'am, except we have this. And he pointed to a memo that was now posted on a column just outside of their little admin office. And it was the memorandum about approved interrogation techniques. And it was only one page. Stress position, disruption of meal and sleeping patterns, loud music played at night, signed by the Secretary of Defense, with a handwritten note in the margin that said, make sure this happens. 2 exclamation points. Okay, it was a copy. So I can only tell you the signature block was Donald Rumsfeld. The signature appeared to be authentic, and the same handwriting in the margin appeared to be the same as the signature, same style. So it was my conclusion that that was signed or approved by the Secretary of Defense. I said to the MP, why is this here? Why are they putting interrogation procedures in the cell block? He said, ma'am, I don't know, but the military intelligence people said to do this, and we're supposed to follow their instructions. And 12 days later, no discussion now. No discussion with anybody in my chain of command, with the legal people. Nobody in my brigade knows anything about this ongoing investigation, at least not to talk about it. And 12 days later, I see the photographs for the first time. Again, shown to me not by anybody in my chain of command, but by the commander of the Criminal Investigation Division, who brings a set of photographs out to me, and I was absolutely blown away. I had no idea. I was thinking, photographs, okay, maybe they took pictures of prisoners behind a concertina wire or something, but could never have imagined what I saw in those photographs. So I said to the commander of the Criminal Investigation Division, where are the MI people in all of this? And one picture in particular had more than 16 soldiers in it, and the prisoners. And he said, well, we're trying to get to the bottom of this, but apparently some of the MI soldiers that they know were guilty were allowed to go back to the States in last year, meaning December or November. So you have excusals already. And he's asking me if I recognize the people in the photograph, and I said I recognize some of them as MPs. I said, but why are the translators in these photographs? He said, ma'am, they aren't translators, those are contract interrogators. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of contract interrogators actually doing military interrogation operations. So when I went to see General Sanchez that night after I saw the photographs, I expected him to do what any commander would do in a situation like that. Lock my heels, chew me out, demand answer something, have a vigorous conversation with me. And he didn't. It was unusual. He said, do you know what this is going to do to my army? As if he were in a different army than I was. No discussion. He didn't want an explanation. He didn't want to talk about it. When I said to him, sir, when I first heard about this investigation, I was already formulating in my mind what I would say. I think the thing to do is to go to the press. I have a good relationship with them. I can give the explanation in English and Arabic. Focus on, no. He said, you are not to discuss this with anyone. If anybody approaches you and asks you for information, you are to direct them to my JAG officer, Judge Advocate General, his lawyer. That was the end of the conversation. No discussion whatsoever. These photographs, those photographs, what did I know? Nothing. Ordered to be silent. And there was no discussion about it whatsoever until we handed over our responsibilities to the incoming brigades, relocated to southern Iraq and then to Kuwait for redeployment. And it was when we arrived down there that they told us that there was going to be an investigation and we couldn't leave. And we were going to wait until General Taguba finished his investigation. So I know that General Taguba was credited with uncovering all of this, but General Taguba did not uncover anything. He was not assigned to Iraq. In fact, he was in Kuwait or in Tampa, Florida for most of the war. And he was dispatched to conduct this investigation because General Sanchez requested it. And the parameters of his investigation were not to go out and find out what created the situation for these photographs, but to go out and investigate the 800th Military Police Brigade and Janice Karpinski. So in his report, when he says, I couldn't investigate the military intelligence because my instructions were very limited, that's what caused the Fay investigation. That's what caused the Schlesinger investigation. That's what caused the Church investigation. And I believe at last count there was 16 or 17 investigations, and all of them under the guidance of the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. Okay, there were some pieces of information that were very important that came out of those investigations, and amongst those pieces of information was the fact that Ambassador Bremer, who we believed throughout the war, and he allowed everybody to believe throughout the war, was working for the State Department. Because that was the plan. 90 days into Iraq, flowers, candy, waving flags, success, U.S. military goes home, and United Nations kicks into high gear with sustainment operations and nation building. And the State Department side of the house would take over at that point. And it took us an investigation in the results, which were announced in March of 2005, and the individual was Admiral Church. And he said, he was asked, who else did you even speak to in the course of this investigation? And he said, I spoke to so-and-so, so-and-so military person. And the senator asked him, did you speak to Ambassador Bremer? And he said, well, no, I did speak to Ambassador Bremer because I was told that this was a DOD investigation, and Ambassador Bremer works for the State Department. And the senator said, well, Admiral, you're wrong. Ambassador Bremer worked for DOD. He worked for Secretary Rumsfeld. So there was no State Department involvement. There was no plan for nation building. There was no plan other than military occupation. So when you hear the reports that the Iraqi army was fired by a representative of the State Department, no. He was told, instructed to fire the Iraqi army by the Secretary of Defense. And he did. There was no balance. There was no plan. And they needed a scapegoat. They found one in me. They needed somebody to support that scapegoat theory, and they found it in the 7 soldiers. 3 of them are still sitting in prisons today. A 10-year sentence, a 7-year sentence, and a 3-year sentence. And they need a lot of company, because there's an awful lot of people who have walked away from this blameless. I said to Larry as I was coming up here, Ambassador Murray stole some of my time, but I'll be brief. And it's difficult to be brief with this subject. It is just simply a pattern of behavior. Nobody provided us with the memorandum. Nobody provided us with the after-action reports from the investigations that had been conducted in Afghanistan and the activities at Guantanamo Bay. The Mora memos now tell us that there was objection to the authorizations in those memos, the Gonzales memos, from the very beginning. And when Mora objected, they worked behind his back because they were determined to do this. People didn't understand at the highest levels that torture was necessary. And when you define torture as not torture, if it doesn't cause organ failure, we have gone down a road that is very, very, very dangerous and impossible to turn around on unless we stop it now. I think at the end of this, there'll be an opportunity for questions, but the important thing to point out is that when you bring slices of experience and firsthand experience and expertise to an equation, in the context of the Bush Commission, the War Crimes Commission, you see that this is not an isolated incident, that it has roots somewhere, deep, dark roots, and that it is consistent with Uzbekistan, Guantanamo Bay, secret renditions. It just goes on and on and on, and it is no longer a small slice, a small problem. It is gross infractions, and the picture is clear. And the time to act is now. Thank you very much.
Daniel Ellsberg is the author and former Defense Department official who leaked the Pentagon Papers. He said, "I would not have thought of copying the Pentagon Papers, risking a possible lifetime in prison without the example of thousands of young Americans who are doing everything they could, including nonviolent disobedience to the draft regulations, to oppose a wrongful, hopeless war. They showed civic courage, and I can attest to its effectiveness. As a government consultant and former official, I felt its power on my life." Daniel Ellsberg.
I've heard two very powerful presentations. I identify, of course, very much as a former official myself with the career of Ambassador Murray. I wasn't an ambassador. But, in fact, I have never heard a former official who is former for the best of reasons, for the reason I'm speaking out. I've never heard him speak that way, ever. In fact, I asked the ambassador if he's ever heard anyone, because I would like him to be aware of how unusual his own behavior is and how much that he has to contribute to trying to encourage others to emulate. It doesn't happen just automatically. His example is the example to be emulated, but you have to understand, say, Ambassador, really ask yourself, not only why you did it, which is interesting, and I'm sure you'll be asked that part of it, as I have, but why not the others? Why not anyone? Why not any of your former colleagues? The fact that he's inquired is, of course, meant to set a teaching example and to keep him quiet. And it's not surprising to people. It's in one, you know, a sufficient reason why very few of them ever would speak out the way he has. A problem of our system, the system in general, Kapinski talks about, which is not exclusive to the United States, of course, by any means, or to this administration. It's not exclusive to this period of history. But I could say a problem that the human species faces in terms of certain patterns of behavior being exhibited now in a nuclear age, which the human species was able to survive for several thousands of years of empire, slavery, torture, class oppression, racism, sexism, etc. Vast numbers of millions of victims in any one generation for these thousands of years, and nevertheless the population was able to grow, spread across the planet, and grow, and empires fell, but other empires rose, and life went on. The threats that are being made now by this president are not the first nuclear threats or threats of aggression that American presidents have ever made. Quite the contrary, virtually every president has made threats, secret threats, I should say threats of initiating nuclear war, generally secretly, of the same kind this president is making right now. But there are two differences. One is they were secret, generally very secret, and there was a reason for that. Up through the Cold War, the American public was very afraid that any given nuclear weapon, especially against an ally of the Soviet Union, people or kind of the Soviet Union, had the potential for blowing the world up, which it did, they were right. Each of these presidents felt that the threat was nevertheless worthwhile, and several of them, including Nixon and others, actually felt and planned that the carrying out of the threat was not as dangerous as the public thought. They knew, for example, that for many of those years, the Soviet Union was enormously less powerful, and even a destructive power than the United States. And they really weren't worried about the Soviet Union replying. In fact, their confidence was misplaced in some of those cases, but they weren't worried. So they felt they made the threats, and they prepared to carry them out, and operational plans were made for carrying them out, going back as early as 1953 in Korea, under Eisenhower, and even before that, under Truman. But they were kept secret because they would have worried the public. So what's the other problem? The other problem is that the public, that's reason now, no longer worries with the end of the Cold War that a single weapon or a handful of weapons against the country, even one friendly or a client of Russia or a traitor of Russia, like Iraq or the current Iran, both of whom are closer to Russia than they are to the U.S., for sure, even without being formal allies, but they're no longer afraid that Russia will respond to that weapon with a nuclear response. And I think they're right in that degree. The likelihood that Russia would respond is, in fact, negligible, except, and this is a real possibility, as a course of escalation that arises out of this evolves over some time. Unfortunately, our fellow Americans have moved now to an acceptance not only of the threat, but the carrying out of the initiation of nuclear war, from a position where, throughout Korea, Vietnam, and other crises, no more than 10%, in a few cases as high as 15%, of the American public would endorse the idea of carrying out a nuclear threat, even to save American soldiers. With the end of the Cold War, that has slipped up to 38% very quickly in the Gulf War. That dismayed me at the time, and that has been true since. Right now, we are being subject to an indoctrination that a nuclear weapon can be used safely in the sense of a for technical reasons against underground sites, underground posts of their nuclear establishment. The public has the impression that that can be done underground without even venting. That is totally false, and such a strike would cause great fallout and essentially a surface burst, even if it went down 35 feet, which they're planning. It would kill very, very many people by fallout. But the public, as I say, is not accepting of that. If this president, almost uniquely, is able to make those threats explicitly, the nuclear option is on the table, and when even Democrats like Nancy Pelosi were asked, are all options, she said, all options are on the table. She was asked, even nuclear option? All options are on the table. Now, she's talking about an initiation of the nuclear world that the General Assembly has repeatedly described as not only a crime against humanity, Christian signature of it, but, quote, the gravest crime against humanity and against the peace. And the President of the United States feels free, and is free, to make such threats and make operational plans to carry them out as side parachutes out of over the old, without apology, and in fact, probably, if he may run on it, if he hasn't carried out, well, not, I should say, congressional or candidates in November, may well support this, including Democrats. So the challenge is up to us in the gravest of terms. And now, bring this back for a moment to the torture. The torture is, as General Karpinski said, part of a pattern in a number of ways. For one, clearly illegal. Even more clearly illegal in domestic terms and in terms of the UN Charter than the initiation of nuclear war. I'll just assert that. But in just strictly legalistic terms, very clearly illegal, as was our initiation of war against Iraq. And the initiation of non-nuclear war against Iran is clearly illegal under the UN Charter as aggression. We, of course, ratified and signed the UN Charter, but the President, of course, boasts of ignoring that piece of paper signed treaty. So that's not going to cause him much political problem. The torture, anti-torture provisions, however, are part of American domestic law, as are the NSA indiscriminate wiretapping, warrantless wiretapping, a clear-cut domestic crime. So in addition to the dangers that are posed by the torture, the effects of that of recruiting Al-Qaeda and recruiting on a massive scale resistance to our presence there. There's pretty resistance anyway on a national level. To the extent that I've studied this, nothing recruits like torture. Nothing. The Shah basically was overthrown because there was hardly a family in Iran that had not had family members tortured by people with the compliance, the complicity, trained by the CIA and others. That made people by the hundreds of thousands willing to demonstrate and for a while be mown down by Shah's troops to protest that, people without arms. Going back now to how the Shah was overthrown. Same thing here. It's dangerous, but I don't want to press that point as much. Except the following. There's another issue. We have then both in the wiretaps, which obviously are not as humanly brutal, although they have great implications for democracy, as the torture. But those two things have in common the fact that they've been clear-cut violations of U.S. domestic law, and for the first time in my experience, in any country I know of in a democracy, the president has acknowledged belatedly, first he was secret about it, understanding that to admit a violation of law was preferable to keep covered up. But when it was leaked out, when it came out, he acknowledged it. Instead of saying, rogues, notice that in the case of the wiretaps, torture, he did manage to pass it off to other people. In the case of the wiretaps, he proudly announced, yes, yes, I did that, and I'm going to keep doing it. Now again, as in torture, as in other things, this is not actually the first time presidents have done this. in the 60s, lived in Johnson, was not only CIA and military intelligence, and NSA, with massive illegal surveillance. But it was kept secret for some years, many years after the Federal Church Committee, 75 and 76. Then the FISA Act, in the case of the wiretaps, was passed with the express purpose of forbidding that, making it clearly illegal in 1978. Imagine if Lyndon Johnson had been found out at the time, 1964, the election campaign, that in the Democratic Convention he was wiretapping and surveilling, bugging every move of Martin Luther King and his lieutenants. That's what he was doing. The bedrooms, the kitchens, the everything. Followed around, wiretaps, everything. That was not known for years. Suppose that had come out during the campaign when I was working for him. But imagine beyond that, he had come out and said, yes, I'm doing that, I was advised this was necessary, and I'm going to keep doing it. Think of that for a moment. That is what Bush is in effect saying right now. It's a challenge to a constitutional democracy, republic, such as we have not seen in this country. Hitler was mentioned here. And of course, to mention Hitler in America, especially for the older people who know about it, is almost to end discussion. It's regarded as so prejudicial and so extreme that if you were to make any kind of analogy to Hitler in any respect, the conversation is over. You're off the program, you're out of discussion, and so forth. So rhetoric, even when I've often felt that in the case of aggression, for example, the analogy was important. After all, Hitler had committed a number of crimes other than the Holocaust and before the Holocaust that are worthy of learning from and forbidding and not emulating and hanging people in Nuremberg if you approve of capital punishment. The fact is that I am afraid ever from making this. A reason that it's, I find it now, this year, very hard to refrain from thinking hard and even expressing that analogy of this. I've looked through history and thought about it for examples of a constitutional democracy being subject to a coup by constituted, elected civilian authority who turn a democracy, like the Weimar regime, into a police state in a short period of time, not by military coup, as in Brazil or Chile or Argentina or Indonesia or so many other places where we have sponsored coups, or by revolutionary movements of various kinds that ushered in police states, but by an elected leader who decided he'd want to rule over police state, not as, in Hitler's case, a man who had been elected with 32% of the vote, and then in the last quasi-free election in March of 33, 42% of the vote, all he could get up to, despite having by that time banned the Communist Party and arrested most of the social democratic leaders immediately in days following the Reichstag fire of February 27. On February 28, Hitler, with only two ministers in the cabinet at that point, Gerhard being one of them, got Hindenburg to issue a decree the next day. And they'd already banned the Communist Party, and that night they had killed thousands of communist and social democratic leaders and arrested tens of thousands, knowing that the communists had nothing to do with the Reichstag fire, nothing. But it was entirely blamed on the communists, one of the, I think at that point, the third largest party. So they were ruled out of the coming election for March 8. On February 28, the next day, the decree said, suspension of all provisions of the Weimar Constitution on civil liberties. No freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly, no freedom of the press, and one other little provision. Suspension of privacy of the postal system. Now, Gonzalez was asked recently by these truncated hearings, by our own Spector about the NSA wiretaps. He wasn't asked by Spector. Spector held a hearing. Somebody else, I think it was Leahy, asked Gonzalez, are you opening mail? And Gonzalez said, not under the program I am testifying about. And Lady then said, are there other programs that go beyond the FISA Act that are being held right now? He said, I'm not here to testify about that. He refused to testify, sure, pretty clearly, I think, that they're opening it, among other things. Having learned that he had been listening to emails, tapping all this, but NSA, all kinds of electronic communications for 4 years previously, after the first 9/11. He hadn't waited for another 9/11 or more for that to happen, which I thought he would. I was talking to a friend in Washington just the other day, actually the guy who helped write the FISA Act. I said, can I refer to that, but he is opening mail? And my friend said, oh, why would he bother? Who uses mail? Well, I said, maybe a few more people are using mail than they used to, under the impression that it might be a little more secure. I do infer that they're, for what that's worth. The point here is that in the present restraining powers, both in the surveillance and the use of the military for surveillance, it's very illegal, unconstitutional under Fourth Amendment, and doing the same under torture. And the peculiar thing about torture, much more than the surveillance, very much more, is that the human reaction to that in a world that has finally, after thousands of years, come generally to regard torture not as entertainment or the right of the monarch or the basis of state security, but as with revulsion and as unacceptable. In that world, and I'm interested now in finding out how that ever came about, as I see how readily the American public, or half of it, adjusts to going back to torture. But that's an interesting question. How can we ever get away from that? How do the Europeans get away when it doesn't seem that humans have that much resistance to it? But what does occur, for the other half of the people at least, is if you can torture, what can't you do? If you can torture secretly and by president's arbitrary decision, what limits are there? That, as I say, is raised much more sharply than in the case of the wiretapping kind of thing. Well, Harold Poe, the dean of the Yale Law School, drew the conclusion that the logic explaining the legal reason by John Yoo, my old, now back here at Holt Hall, and by David Addington, now chief of staff of Cheney, having been with him for a year or more, Bybee, who's now a judge in the court, Gonzalez, and Alito, just put on the Supreme Court, named five people there, who have assured the president as lawyers that he has inherent powers as commander-in-chief, both to violate the FISA law, that hadn't come up when they were written those things, but they pointed, their logic points directly to that, he has those powers, and to torture. Now, as Harold Coe pointed out, dean of the Yale Law School, if his inherent powers in wartime as commander-in-chief allow that, torture being, after all, the ultimate expression of absolute power over individuals, even in some degree, a significant degree, a human point of view, greater than the ability to execute. Torture is, prolonged torture of various kinds, is worse than death. People who are suffering it long for death. And they're rarely going to tell you 10 years later or 20 years later how happy they are that they lived through that instead of being killed. Torture, the kinds we've heard, if the president or the leader has the right to do that, the power to use that, then he has unlimited power. So Harold Cole pointed out, if the president has that inherent power, he has the power to order and carry out genocide, massacre, to to reinstitute slavery, cannibalism, or whatever. There really is no limit. Now, that's not just a hypothetical chain of logic to follow. The fact is that what these lawyers, including new Supreme Court justice, presumably Roberts too, who wasn't pressed on it, but Alito definitely, and the Attorney General, Herbert Gonzalez, have stated essentially in so many words, there is no limit of any kind, not just the UN Charter, you know, President, you know, hosts of disregarding the Constitution, which privately he has referred to as just a piece of paper. He hasn't said that publicly. Domestic law, legislation, he has literally no restraint on him to do anything. Now, it isn't just torture alone that follows from that, bad enough as that is. When I say he has the power to commit genocide, every president we've had since Harry Truman, I should say, since Eisenhower, when the H-bomb came in, has believed he had the power to genocide, to threaten, prepare, and if necessary, order our armed forces to carry out not just genocide on the Soviet Union, homicide, multi-genocide, ethnic group, racial groups, everything. Hundreds of millions of people, hundreds of millions. I have seen the plans for that. I have PSYOP access, similar operation plan, general war plan, plans for genocide. We're not planning now hundreds of millions to kill in Iran. It would probably be just millions. But that's already a massacre of genocide, very obviously, and it leads us on a path. No president has ever been challenged on his, by anyone in Congress, on his right to do that without warning to Congress or any consent by Congress, any regulation whatever, when he chose to do it. No restraint has ever been put on any president. We are using our weapons right now. The way you use a gun when you point it at somebody's head, whether or not you pull the trigger. If you get your way without pulling the trigger, that's the best use you could get. And that's why presidents get their weapons, to use them that way. And we are setting an example now to every country in the world. With the end of the Cold War, without the pretense that our survival is threatened, that we, the richest, strongest country in the world, with military alternatives to nuclear weapons, outnumbering, outscale all the rest of the world combined, we have the right and necessity to initiate nuclear war against the non-nuclear state. We are, in other words, promoting proliferation in a very drastic way. I want to make one last point to put this in context. I think this drew out this willingness on the U.S. part to make such threats and support them. And other countries have been imitating us now, and we're afraid we'll imitate us more, by our policy that was adopted secretly in World War II by the British first, and the Americans, of strategic bombing, or what Churchill called terror bombing, area bombing, in which civilians were explicitly the target for firebombing, not starting in Dresden. The Americans were involved in Hamburg in 1943 by the firestorm. In Dresden, it wasn't just British, but it was British, but it wasn't just British. The Americans came in the second day. I should say the morning after the firestorm had killed, the most realistic estimate now is something like 38 or 40,000 people, or bigger estimates have been made. Shortly after that, the U.S. carried out the largest massacre in human history, the largest act of terror on a single day in human history. How many people here are familiar with what happened on the night of March 9th, 10th, 9th and 10th, 1945? How many people know what I'm talking about? Does he have? Mm-hmm. How many do not? Okay, well, most do. More do than I would have expected. But those who do know, that was the night that we burned alive between 80 and 120,000 civilians in Tokyo. And what reminded me of it tonight, I'm sorry to say, and look how away, we've heard these horrifying descriptions, horrified by Ambassador Murray, of this absolute power by Uzbekistan on a number of individuals. In fact, you mentioned two, but presumably there were a lot more. One little fact about the firebombing of Tokyo that always impressed me when I read it. Most of the deaths were by suffocation of the oxygen being burned up by the firestorm. People died in shelters and in basements. But those who escaped those went onto the streets trying to get to the canals. However, they found that the asphalt was melted and burning. So many of them burned like candles with their feet stuck in the asphalt. But those who got to the canals that crisscrossed Tokyo, like Venice, jumped into canals to escape the firestorm. But the canals were boiling, and tens of thousands boiled in the canal. Doing that for 5 months before Hiroshima, steadily every day, killed an estimated 800,000 civilians, mostly women and children, men are off war outside Japan, babies burned to death. In that context, of course, torture alone seems almost trivial. But of course, it's the same, it's on the same pattern. And after that, of course, the atom bomb that presented to President Truman no moral problem. Quite rightly, that's what he said. I felt no moral problem. Very understandably, his predecessor, FDR, had authorized and carried out killing by fire as many Japanese children, infants, babies, in front of their families. And those who didn't die were burned for life, lost arms, limbs, whatever. If you were doing that as much as you could for 5 months, doing it with one bomb in a night, killing less people, perhaps 80,000 in Hiroshima, 48,000 in Nagasaki, Tokyo may have killed more than both of those together in immediate effects in one night. So there's no moral problem, we were just doing it more efficiently. We have now arrived at the point where that ability to destroy cities with a single bomb, now it's metropolitan areas, the big ones, has passed directly to 8 or 9 countries, depending on how you count. Strictly speaking, India and Pakistan have not yet succeeded in producing an H-bomb, which increases the thermal effects, the fire effects, vastly. But they will if the U.S. renews testing, which I believe this administration intends to do and will do with the next 9/11 or the wake of an Iranian case. They'll get H-bombs. And then all the nuclear powers will get H-bombs. Israel is going to have them right now, which does make a difference in terms of genocide and on the side, and then other countries will get them too. What we're talking then about is human values, not invented in this generation, but human values that have been expressed in war, the killing of civilians for a long time, but made technically feasible on a scale that was never before seen for just two countries, UK and America. For a while, before the A-bomb, only those two countries could destroy a city by air. With the A-bomb, anybody with an A-bomb could do it. It's a difference. We weren't subject to any threat like that before that. And the British were, because they were close enough to Germany. But with our oceans, we weren't subject. By promoting proliferation all those years, we have made ourselves vulnerable. Soon it will be many other countries. And these A-bombs and H-bombs will be in the hands of humans of the kind that have supported torture all these years and have been in war and aggression, except that some have gotten away from it a little bit. And the second part is that, so I would say this is a species not to be trusted with nuclear weapons. But beyond that, this is a superpower right now with a president who believes from legal advice that he already has the powers that Hitler assumed with emergency decrees only after the Reichstag fire, and then when he was voted emergency powers in late March. And by June, there was a one-party state. We have, in other words, convergent crises right now toward democracy and to world order in terms of aggression in Iran. It is up to us. Our leaders have almost unanimously failed to show us any kind of civil courage in terms of speaking out to be saw an ambassador. By the way, we did have one person of ambassadorial rank, Anne Wright, who was in Mongolia, who resigned just before the chairman working with her left to continue to register residency in Crawford, Texas. There was two other, John David Keeson and John Brown, who resigned and has spoken out. I did ask Anne Wright why she didn't take a lot of secrets with her and put them out, but she did. She said, we didn't get a lot of interesting cables in Mongolia. Unless officials can identify with the position, although there are many who understand they're in the same position as General Karpinski, Ambassador Merkel. You can see that inside. Sidehurst tells us that they are appalled by the nuclear planning they are doing, and some of them are thinking of resigning. When I saw that, my thought was, resign when? After the bomb? Or before? And if before, what good will that do? Nothing. It will save no lives. No lives. Before or after. Don't resign. Leak. Disclose documents on a large scale. Current documents. Don't do what I did. Wait till the bombs have fallen. Wait till new wars have started in Iran or elsewhere. Wait till, if you like, the torture has been extended to the detention camps being constructed in this country right now for the reason of KBR for Halliburton. Don't wait for all of the detention camps to be filled and the torture to come back from Abu Ghraib to where I'm sure we have a lot of them in our prisons right now, but mostly for black poor, very poor people. And the torture will now spread as these things have attended to Middle Easterners and then to people like those in this audience. It is disgraceful that John Yoo is able, in Bolt Hall here, to put out these theories, to put out books and so forth, without, it's fine that you can say them, that's our country, that's First Amendment, but that he says them without challenge by other members of the faculty or by students. I spoke more than I should. I'll just close with this. It was announced that I spoke at the first vigil here against torture outside Bolt Hall. In theory, the class that they thought you was in, but it turned out he was in at the moment. There were zero students in about the 17 people who attended that vigil. How many students, aside from the people of the Constitution summer group, which I applaud very much, a terrific group, aside from those, how many students are here tonight? Can I see the hands up? Oh, that's more than I thought. Congratulations. I thank you for being here. I actually was expecting about five hands after zero at those vigils, and I was prepared to say pretty pitiful showing for the student body as a whole, but actually that's a decent showing for this, and enough of you to spread the word to your fellow students. They and we are living with a challenge to the democracy that they grew up in so far, with all its limitations. But anybody who thinks that the Patriot Act is the last word in the abridgment of our freedoms is not unrealistic. We have to live up, it's up to us to press our so-called leaders in Congress and elsewhere to act on their oaths to obey the Constitution, not the Fuhrer. Thank you.
just very quickly, we've heard some incredible testimony, and if you've heard Craig Murray, Janice Karpinski, and Dan Ellsberg and aren't yet convinced that this regime needs to be driven out yesterday, I don't know what more we can do. I'm going to make a very quick appeal for money. We need money because millions of people need to hear what you have heard tonight. We need to take this to students. We need to take this to campuses across the country. If there's no student movement in this country, there is no chance to stop this regime. I mean, just what Dan was saying about the gravity of the danger, I just couldn't agree with more. We have to be a student movement unless we take this commission, World Can't Wait, these kind of speakers, this kind of information to campuses across this country, and to do that takes tens of thousands of dollars. I think you know that, and one of the ways all of us have to step up what we're doing is stepping up. Maybe you are not a government official who can leak a document or resign from your position, but you can write a check. You can go to the website at www.bushcommission.org for the Bush Commission, or www.worldcampwait.org. The hour is very late. We had planned to have a question and answer period. The presentations went on long. We started late. I would recommend that we just conclude this evening, and if people have questions, to simply come down and ask them. Thank you very much for coming out tonight.